We spoke with the four school superintendents of South Florida about a slew of issues. You can always go back and listen to any of those conversations at WLRN.org/sundial. Let's begin in our northernmost district, Palm Beach County, and our conversation with Dr. Donald Fenoy. We asked him about reduced tax revenue on a local and state level and how that would play out with his budget.
We are projecting similar to Dade and Broward, and if not the entire country. Our chief finance officers are all in cohesion and collaborating that there will be shortfalls. You know, obviously, those of us in the state of Florida, Disney World still isn't open. Tourism has not opened back up. Those of us that are still working and staying home aren't spending money on luxury items. So, you know, our budgets are primarily built on sales tax and property taxes. And so we're all preparing for those realities. In Palm Beach County's case, we one of the first decisions I made back in March was to freeze our budget and to freeze hiring for as long as we can so that we can begin to save dollars there. We're looking at all of our organizational charts. So we recognize that it's coming. I don't think it'll be an immediate impact. We're still waiting on the legislator to tell us if they're going to cut existing budgets or the budget that was just approved. But we realize as the years progress and the quarters start to show shortfalls in revenues, that we will have to adjust accordingly to those numbers.
So right now you've had a hiring freeze, you're cutting contracts, and again, still have to wait and see what those numbers are going to be when we get into the next budget and what legislators are going to be doing, with their budget. But I'd imagine, do you have a plan for if it's 10%, 20%? I mean, we've seen where they think up to 30% in some cases.
Yeah, so we are actually, our executive team are running scenarios 5, 10, 15, 20, 20%. So we are running those models now. Our finance team is similar to the other school systems, are running those simulations. It's going to be tough if we get up to that 15, 20, 25%, 30. It's going to be very tough for all of us.
And when you run that simulation, you get to those big numbers. I mean, what do you see? What do you think? How bad will that be? What kind of things are you going to have to do?
Well, I mean, I think everything is on the table. I think during the Great Recession, we looked at furloughs. We looked at, downsizing the organization. Most of what we hope to do over the next year is through attrition. So just not filling jobs that are vacated through retirements or people choose other things to do. And then we would have to then put the right people in the right positions to still not lose a lot of the continuity of services. And I think in some cases, we're going to have to decide on what services we will no longer provide just because we can't afford it or we don't have the human capital or manpower to do that. So I think all possibilities are what we're looking at now. Obviously, people have reserves, but, you know, reserves aren't reoccurring costs. And once they're depleted, they're gone. And so, I mean, we're really studying every ounce of our budget to see what can and cannot be done.
And when do you start talking about before cutting teachers, perhaps salary cuts in, you know, to try to keep them? I mean, is that part of the option?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I say everything is on the table, we in Palm Beach County will begin our intense budget conversations with the board on the 20th. And then we will have a regular conversation with the board in a public space so they can see where we are. But again, so much is actually driven by what the legislator, you know, decides. And so, again, right now, everything, and for the audience, everything right now is speculation and assumptions and assessments. There are no facts yet. So we're just running these simulations based on, you know, what happened during the Great Recession, what our finance people know to be best practices. And then we have sort of a conglomerate of school systems across the country through the Council of Great City Schools and other groups that we're members of that are also looking at this issue.
And if you have to make salary cuts, I mean, is that everybody across the board? Does that include you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it'd be me first, to be honest. I mean, it would be most of the initial decisions will be made at the executive level of cutting. But we make a small part of the budget. 75 to 80% of our budget are just in people. And we, as a system, have pushed as many resources as possible into the schools. So if the numbers get too big, there will be no way to avoid some sort of impact at the school level.
From there, we move south to Broward County, the second largest district in the state, and our conversation with Superintendent Ronald Runcie. We discussed his district's preparations and challenges to conduct distance learning.
One thing I would say is that we were very fortunate in Broward County to have started this journey probably about 4 years ago, putting in the infrastructure, training our teachers to be able to do this. We had invested in a online blended learning environment with a system called Canvas, which is our learning management system. We'd also built a authentication process for teachers and students where they would log in, they would be authenticated, they would be put into a virtual dashboard, and then would be able to go into their classrooms where they would see assignments online, they would submit their work, they would have had access to digital resources. The second thing that we had put in place was reducing our student to computer ratio. In 2011, when I arrived in the district, it was somewhere between 6 to 7 students to per computer. We'd made significant investments and reduced that almost down to 1 to 1. That enabled us to distribute laptops out to any student that wanted them. And so far, we've distributed over 90,000 computers to students.
And you said a second ago that this started 4 years ago. Were you thinking about remote learning back then?
Well, yes, we were thinking about blended learning because we felt that technology would continue to play a greater role in education and also help to support our teachers and students to be more effective and create more engaging experiences for our students and also be able to connect them with more and more resources.
What's been the biggest challenge so far for your teachers?
Yeah. So the majority of our teachers were used to this, and I've had biweekly chats with our teachers to see how they are. So those who were actually using it, and I will tell you that was about 60% of our high school teachers, 50% of our middle schools. At the elementary level, we only had about 19%. So that's where we find some of the biggest challenges. You know, it's just really trying to get them to be comfortable with migrating from classroom to the distance learning format. That's probably like the biggest challenge for them. And then adjusting their teaching, their lessons. It's not the same. You can't have kids online for 2-3 hours straight just doing a straight lesson. There has to be some modification to that. I think the other piece that we're finding out is that there's a lot more of a need for social emotional supports. Just forget about the academics, right? Just the actual connection, the human face-to-face interaction is enormously positive for our kids, especially in this moment where they're not able to see their friends, they're not able to see their teachers. I know some teachers have invited the principal, the custodian, even the anybody that's available to join their virtual sessions so that the students can actually see the folks they normally would see and continue to have those connections.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that part yet. You're tracking the students to make sure they're logging on daily. How are you doing that?
It's through the system that we built, right? So it really simulates a school. So when you sign on through our what we call our portal, that's the equivalent of showing up at school at our single point of entry and entering the school. Once you're signed on, you would then go into, you would see your dashboard of options. That would be the equivalent of being into, let's say, your homeroom. And then you would actually go into Canvas, which would literally list your schedule for the day. And you would go to your first, click on your first period class. You would enter that classroom and you would be interacting with the teacher.
And are you, I mean, if a student isn't showing up, are you reaching out to them?
So our schools and our teachers specifically know which students are not engaged, and they are personally reaching out to the families. Some of them are even reaching other students who may know those students to be able to get in touch with them. We have our social workers. They've just been tremendous. They've done over 10,000 calls and referrals so far. We have our family therapists that are engaged and our administrators. It's really been, you know, all hands on deck to make sure we connect with those kids.
We continue now to Miami-Dade Schools and Superintendent Alberto Carvalho. One of his greatest concerns is the slide and how far back students will fall because of the disruption to classroom learning.
Even before we shut down the school system and started our instructional continuity plan, which relies on distance learning, I announced across the country that I had a huge concern, which I continue to have, particularly for the most fragile children, those who live in poverty, those who are performing below grade level currently, English language learners, and certainly students with disabilities, and homeless children, children in foster care, who ordinarily experience what we refer to as an academic regression or a summer slide during the summer. But what I said then, I stand by still today, is that across the country, we will see, we will experience an unprecedented historic slide as a result of the compound effect of the summer slide preceded by a disrupted fourth quarter that we are going through right now. And that's why not only did we recognize that huge liability for the most fragile children to begin with, but we went to work to develop a mitigation plan to secure expanded learning opportunities throughout the summer, leading into next year and throughout next year for those students who are at greatest risk.
And part of that plan, I want to know, how are we tracking students' progress right now?
So very good question, Lewis. So as a result of our instructional continuity plan 2.0, we built in accountability measures, not only for attendance, but also connectivity. So we know, actually, with a high level of accuracy, number one, the average daily attendance. And I have to tell you that yesterday's average daily attendance was 93%, very comparable to what it was last year around this time. Only had two schools below 80% and no school below 77%, which is stunning. With that said, we are absolutely aware of pockets of students, even in high-performing schools as well as high-poverty schools, that are not connecting frequently enough or are attaining, accumulating an excessive number of absences, or on the basis of feedback from teachers, they are not logging in sufficient work to earn a decent grade.
And do we know why that is? When you say comparable, is that comparable to just a regular school year?
Right. In terms of the attendance,
yeah.
In terms of daily average, it is comparable. Maybe 1 to 2 percentage points off from a typical school day last year around this time. But, and that, by the way, we are close to 100% connected, meaning close to 100%. We're at 99.8% of the children connected. That very small percentage of students who are still disconnected, we are confounded by it, but we have some hypotheses. We've had wellness checks performed on some of these kids. Most of them are immigrant children. Most of them used to live somewhere where the neighbors tell us the parents had to move because they had to break the lease. Phones disconnected because probably economic conditions. And I have to believe that some of these account for some of our unaccompanied minors who are experiencing a great deal of anxiety and stress. So that's why the connectivity percentage, meaning a lot of these kids had devices or have devices, but some of them, are not connecting frequently enough to maintain or continue their learning. And so, that is why we have this concern, and that's why we've developed these mitigation strategies.
Finally, we spoke with Mark Porter, superintendent of Monroe County Schools. He shared his thoughts on what could happen if we reopen campuses in the fall and someone becomes infected with COVID. In May, an employee at a key school tested positive, and a lot had to happen to make the campus safe again.
I think it is a little bit of foreshadowing. I think the tricky part will be that each and every situation will have to be assessed on kind of an individual basis. I will acknowledge that this particular employee had been somewhat mobile about the school building, so we did have an impact with a few other employees who had contact, and as you just accurately indicated, they were put into a self-quarantine for 14 days. So one of the things that we have asked of our employees when they do come back into our buildings, and they have been allowed to do so on a very limited basis, is we generally have asked them to make a very minimal amount of movement, you know, throughout the building. It's kind of come in the door, go to your destination, and return by the same path, so to speak.
But you
and some of that.
You,
go ahead.
You went, but you did basically contact tracing. You had to figure out everybody that person came into contact with.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly the protocol that the Department of Health, they really take over when you have this identified case, and you then cooperate and work with them. And so we did have to do the contact tracing. But I, I think it's something we're going to have to keep in mind when we do bring people back, is that, you know, we're not quite as free to roam perhaps as much as we had in the past, because, again, what we had to do here was we had to clean those areas that this individual employee had had passed through for whatever reason. And the more we can limit some of that, I think, you know, the less disruptive, you know, any type of an outbreak, you know, might be. Because at some point, you certainly will be faced with the possibility of having to shut down an entire school. But I think initially, I think it'll be more of a partial, you know, kind of a cleaning, a partial shutdown. And so these are just the kind of things we're going to have to kind of figure out how to deal with from the fall of 2020.
It wasn't that long ago when Hurricane Irma hit. And, you know, the Category 4 storm in 2017, are Monroe schools fully recovered from that?
I think our schools are perhaps better recovered from that than some portions of our community. You know, I have to be honest, you know, we were back in school. I still have these numbers in my head, 13, 15, and 18 days of missed school after Hurricane Irma, which I thought was a pretty aggressive plan to get kids back in school, but our communities really wanted our kids back in school. The schools we build are not built cheaply, but they did hold up extremely well, and so we were able to really get things back in order. So I think our schools have recovered. I'm sure there's still some of our staff members who are struggling with some of the after effects of Hurricane Irma, and to be honest, some of our families.
And sticking with Hurricane Irma recovery, you know, did that trauma, you know, is it made it harder for people, or do you think that that experience helped in getting you ready for what we're now living?
I think it actually helped, to be honest. I know some people might have felt re-traumatized a little bit, but I think in general it has given our employees in particular, and I think our students also, you know, some sense of resilience. And I think they've proven that they can bounce back and bounce back well. Actually, the year of Hurricane Irma, which I think was in 17-18, was actually a year that this district moved from a B district grade to an A district grade. So that's the kind of effort that was put forth by everyone in the latter half of that year on the heels of the recovery period from Hurricane Irma. So I really think in many ways it's benefited us in terms of developing and certainly testing our resilience, and I think we're seeing some of the benefit of that now.
Those are our conversations with South Florida's school superintendents, Palm Beach County Superintendent Dr. Donald Fennoy, Broward County Superintendent Ronald Runcie, Miami-Dade Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, and Monroe County Superintendent Mark Porter. You can find these interviews at WLRN.org/sundial.